I am very excited to hear this presentation. I have read the book, and it's absolutely fascinating. And it's just kind of been serendipity, I think, for how the approach was made to me about the book. And I was able to have lunch with him one time and get to know each other better. And I just think there's pieces, you know, we've concentrated a lot on doctrine as our exit out of the church, and this book reveals a piece of history that is just very unknown by anybody, at least to any extent, that not even close to what he has covered in the book. So I'm going to turn the time over now to David to give us his presentation. Thank you.
Well, good morning. My name is Dave Nelson, and I am an ex-Mormon. Thank you to Peter Danzig, because I also run on coffee. About 15 years ago, when I decided to leave Mormonism after a period of about 13 years, I still remember my first morning out of Mormonism. I went down to the coffee shop on the Texas A&M campus and had my first Java in 13 years, and it tasted so good. So I highly recommend it for you. Peter gave you some very good advice. I am grateful to Sue Emmett and to the board of directors of the Ex-Mormon Foundation for inviting me and my wife Ruth here this weekend. I'm so happy to be able to talk to you. My personal religious journey has provided me with a fascinating topic for historical research, and I'll get into how that happened a little bit later. But when I talk about the Mormon Church in Germany under the Third Reich, I check my religious prejudices at the conference room door. I consider my work to be scholarly and objective. The presentation I will give this morning would be the same as if I were presenting it at the American Historical Association, the American Academy of Religion, the Mormon History Association, the Sunstone Symposium, the John Whitmer Historical Society, some symposium at Brigham Young University, or, as unlikely as it might seem, if I were invited to speak on the same subject at Fair Mormon. No chance, okay? So if you'll bear with me, I want to give you a little bit of a flavor of my book. And I'm going to read a bit of passage from it. And if it starts to bog down, I'm going to skip over some things. But this comes from chapter 14, entitled Mormons and Jews, an Inconvenient Association. Yay, it's working. Egon Engelbert Weiss was a Mormon of Jewish descent, a member of the Vienna branch of the Swiss-Austrian mission in 1938. Although few details of his life have survived, the historical record offers a reasonable synopsis of how he lived before and after Hitler's troops marched into Austria in March of that year. Jews had enjoyed full rights of citizenship in the Habsburg Empire since a decree from Emperor Franz Joseph in 1869. Under the Austrian Republic that emerged after the First World War, Mormons like Weiss peacefully coexisted with others, even though their small religious denomination numbered in the hundreds and exerted no political influence. As a citizen of Jewish origin in the 1930s, Weiss probably could have been counted among Austria's intellectually and commercially privileged. Some 62% of Vienna's lawyers, 47% of its medical doctors, and 29% of its university faculty were Jewish. According to the Nazis' own estimates, one quarter of Vienna's businesses were owned and operated by Jews, including 60% of those in banking or, quote, big industry. When the Nazis took control of Austria, the Mormon mission leaders had one concern. How do we configure the boundaries of the German-speaking missions to conform to the new political reality? Brother Weiss, as his fellow Mormons called him, had more serious worries. Regardless of his devotion to Mormonism, His pedigree branded him with the indelible mark of Judaism. After Austria became a member of the Third Reich, all of the dangers and indignities that Germany's Jews had experienced over the past 5 years hit the Austrian Jewish community like a sudden thunderclap. In just one day, when Jewish students were banned, Austrian universities lost 40% of their students. Shortly after the Anschluss, Adolf Eichmann established the Central Office for Jewish Emigration in Vienna, which was really an agency to promote intimidation of Jews and pressure them to leave the Reich. For those Jews who remained, it later coordinated ghettoization and deportation to the concentration camps. Its subsidiary agency, the Asset Transfer Office, stole Jewish possessions and transferred them to non-Jews. The horror of Kristallnacht did not stop at the former national border. In Egon Weiss's Vienna, paramilitary thugs burned 42 synagogues, vandalized and looted 4,038 Jewish shops, and desecrated the city's Jewish cemeteries. If Weiss's residence was like most others occupied by Jews, he watched a mob destroy it. With no other recourse, Brother Weiss took a pen in hand and appealed to his Mormon co-religionist in the American Zion. On November 23, 1838, 2 weeks after Kristallnacht, he wrote to the First Presidency and Salt Lake City. Then he addressed 8 additional letters to former missionaries in Utah and Idaho, whom he had befriended when they served in the German-speaking missions. Weiss complained that, quote, conditions are terrible for us Jewish people, and we have absolutely no hope of working at our learned trades. It is simply that we must get away from here, unquote. Addressing the church presidency as dear brother, he asked for help, quote, to make the necessary affidavit to enable his family to escape to America, unquote. Weiss assured his church leadership that his family had adequate financial support for the journey and to sustain himself upon arrival in the United States. Quote, we can't enter the United States without having resident Americans vouching for our integrity and possible worth as future citizens, unquote. His letter closed, your brother in the gospel. No available record reveals a response. But Jewish pleas for help addressed to the Mormon hierarchy ran into a solid resistance from the second-ranking member of the LDS leadership triad, J. Reuben Clark. Clark dispatched boilerplate responses to most. Historian D. Michael Quinn, who wrote 2 biographies of Clark, summarized the language used by the Mormon's first counselor whenever such a plea came across his desk. Quote, in regard to your interesting letter, President Clark began his standard reply to desperate Jews in January 1939, we have had so many requests of this sort from various persons, including members of the church, that we have found it necessary to ask to be excused from making the required guarantee. His letter recommended that the petitioners, some of whom were LDS, contact Jewish organizations for help. The church's response to another lifelong Mormon, Austrian Mormon of Jewish lineage, was not as perfunctory, but it contained the same refusal. Richard Siebenschein, also of Vienna, wrote 2 letters, dated December 25th and 28th, 1938, addressed directly to Heber J. Grant, with whom Siebenschein claimed to have shared an apartment when both served as Mormon missionaries in Tokyo in 1901. Claiming that he wanted only an affidavit as required by the laws of the USA for entry into your country, Grant's former missionary companion pled, we are not in trouble through fault of our own, except for our Jewish descendants. This time, J. Reuben Clark responded with a chatty letter that detailed the present circumstances of each missionary with whom Siebenschein served in Japan at the turn of the 20th century. He said President Grant was away from the city, but that the prophet would be pleased to know Siebenschein remembered him and had written him. Then, in a startling switch of tone, Clark reverted to his form letter verbiage, asking to be excused from providing such assistance because the church has received so many requests of this sort. The LDS Church thus erected a firewall between its resources and the Jews who needed them to leave Germany, even if they had converted to Mormonism. It did not, however, refrain from using its influence to seek diplomatic help for those not tainted by a Jewish heritage. Several months prior to the arrival of Weiss's plea, using a term made infamous by the Nazis, Clark requested the assistance of his former State Department colleagues in expediting the immigration to the United States of a Mormon couple. Quote, she and her husband are Aryan natives and nationals of Switzerland. Subsequently, according to Clark, to Mike Quinn, Clark privately urged the State Department not to help Jewish children to leave Nazi Germany if their parents were trying to send them to the United States. Thus, if a non-Jew needed assistance, the LDS hierarchy sometimes stood ready to help. If a Jew asked, it not only refused, but at least in one case, Clark urged its government not to assist. It's this kind of heart-rending discovery that characterized my 15 years of research into the Mormon Church's history in Nazi Germany. More than two decades ago, my 13-year-old stepson posed a question at the dinner table. Jeff was in the seventh grade. He was taking his first world history course. His teacher told him that prisoners in Hitler's concentration camps wore colored triangles on their armbands to indicate their reason for confinement. Political prisoners wore red triangles. Common criminals, green. Street bums and the work shy, black. Jehovah's Witnesses, purple. And Jews, a yellow Star of David, which could be seen as two yellow triangles placed atop one another. Jeff had learned the Orthodox version of Mormon history in Sunday school and primary. The Mormons had been persecuted everywhere they went, he believed, so obviously German Latter-day Saints must have had their own colored armbands in the concentration camps. That kind of question had never occurred to me, so I did some research. Sometime later, I got back to him with an answer. One that his true-believing Mormon mother didn't like very much. Son, I said, the Mormons in Nazi Germany didn't have much to do with the concentration camps, but those who did were as likely to have been the guards. The research I did to answer Jeff's question turned into a graduate level paper at Texas A&M, later an award-winning paper at the year 2000 Conference of the Mormon History Association, and eventually my doctoral dissertation in history. At each level, I strove not only to tell how the Mormons survived and prospered in the Third Reich, but how they remember those events today. Historical memory, sometimes called collective memory, is a term scholars use to describe how the descendants of historical actors reconcile the often imperfect behavior of their forebears and how they come to terms with it today. In telling the story of how today's Mormons choose to remember their experience in Nazi Germany, I use the terms like memory beacons and dimmer switches. Latter-day Saint history during the Third Reich, told without these filters of post-war manipulation of memory, does not paint a pretty picture. First, we will talk about history. Then, we'll get into the manipulation of collective memory, which makes Mormon history in Nazi Germany tolerable for today's faithful. We will start with a few important points, punctuated by some relative examples. First, Mormons were not persecuted in Nazi Germany, nor did they fear the German state any more than did ordinary Germans. German Mormons were ordinary Germans. As historian Eric Johnson has written, most Germans slept soundly at night, worked productively by day, and enjoyed their lives during the peacetime years of National Socialist rule. Why should they not have? The economy was improving, most were finding employment, and their country was regaining its pride and was still at peace. They knew there was a strong police presence, a surfeit of laws placing limitations on personal freedom, and potential danger for those who refused to comply with Hitler's wishes. Many grumbled and complained privately, but most found little difficulty in conforming. Nazi terror posed no threat to most ordinary Germans. Second, when a Mormon got in trouble with the National Socialist government, it was because of an individual transgression, not because of his religion. Furthermore, the Nazi government only went after the individual transgressors. The LDS Church as a whole never felt the hot lash of Hitler's disfavor when some Mormons transgressed. This applied both to German members and American missionaries. For example, in 1939, a German district leader in Hamburg asked for the mailing addresses of young Mormons who were in the military. He wanted to send them church publications. That got the attention of military counterintelligence, which ordered his arrest and interrogation. But the incident did not spill over or affect Mormons in other parts of Germany. During the same year, a pair of immature young American missionaries photographed themselves stark naked, except for wearing a Nazi flag as a breechcloth. When the employees of a camera shop owned by a German Mormon reported the incident after the missionaries sent in the film for development, why didn't they just send it home? Maybe they didn't want their dad to see. Okay. The shop owner was sent to a concentration camp, and the missionaries had to flee the country. But their companions in the same town were never in trouble. Third, with notable exceptions, Mormons did not resist the government of the Third Reich. In 1937, a politically astute young American named Alvin Schoenaals reported to Nuremberg as his final area of labor. He had worked as an office missionary in Basel, Switzerland for most of his mission, but was transferred to Germany in order to make a few conversions before he headed home. In other words, to have a few missionary battlefield, you know, conversion stories so he could talk at testimony meeting and all of that. Accustomed to criticizing the government in his letters home from Switzerland, the young man made the mistake of writing unflattering things about the Third Reich, which were intercepted by Nazi postal censors. Arrested and imprisoned, he received help from Mission President Philemon Kelly, who enlisted the aid of the American Consul in Munich. The mission president also hired a lawyer on the young man's behalf. After 3 weeks, he was expelled from Germany, but no other missionaries or members suffered because of his transgression. Fourth, when a few individual Mormons did resist, their actions met with disapproval from church leaders and fellow members. We'll talk in more detail about this when I discuss the noted German Mormon resister, Helmut Hubner, and a courageous branch president who we don't know very well, Max Reschke, one who had the filters applied to his heroism. Fifth, when Hitler came to power, the American mission presidents formulated a survival strategy. But it quickly became apparent that Nazi Germany afforded the Mormons opportunities they had not enjoyed in Wilhelmine Germany or the Weimar Republic. The LDS Church exploited commonalities between Mormonism and National Socialism, not only to survive, but also to prosper in the Third Reich. I'm not the first person to have discovered this. Staffordshire University historian Christine Elizabeth King first noticed these synergies in her groundbreaking work on the new religions in Nazi Germany. She entitled it The Nazi State and the New Religions, and she published it with the Mellon Press in 1981. Three decades ago, she said that the Nazis and the Mormons shared a common Weltanschauung, that is, a conjunction of worldviews. There were historical and cultural reasons. The church had equity to protect in Nazi Germany. By 1930, Germany had surpassed Canada to have more Latter-day Saints than any country except the United States. When Hitler came to power in 1933, the American mission presidents feared losing control over their German congregations. No passage can be found in their correspondence that expresses the fear that the Nazis would shut down German congregations. Instead, the mission presidents were afraid that the government might send the missionaries home. They responded by dusting off an old statement of belief, the 12th Article of Faith, in essence, the Mormons' version of the Gospel of John's admonition to render unto Caesar that which is Caesar's. But the Mormons had not always obeyed civil authority at home or abroad, especially during the first 80 years of Mormonism in Germany. During the Wilhelmine period, during the 19th century to the beginning of the First World War, American Mormon missionaries were in constant conflict with the German government. When one missionary would be expelled from a German state, instead of going home, he would exchange places with another expelled missionary from another state. If a postal censor refused to allow the printing of a religious tract in one town, the missionaries would find a sympathetic censor elsewhere, have it printed, and then circulate the banned pamphlet under the nose of the original censor. American missionaries during the 1800s were constantly misrepresenting themselves as students, English teachers, and commercial entrepreneurs in order to circumvent bans on Mormon missionary work in the various German states. But in the Third Reich, the Mormons became fastidious observers of the law. In Hitler's Germany, Mormons would be both good church members and good citizens. But then the story takes an interesting turn. The Mormons in Germany did more than what was necessary to survive. They exploited areas of commonality between Mormonism and National Socialism. The opportunities available under the Third Reich were simply too good to pass up. They learned to work the system to their advantage. Sometimes it was a mutual interest in genealogical research. During Imperial and Weimar Germany, pastors and priests often denied Mormons access to parish registers and archives. Simply put, they didn't want their Catholic or Lutheran parishioners to be baptized posthumously into the LDS Church. But with the Nazi penchant for genealogy, the Mormons celebrated newfound access to the archives. A Deseret News article in late 1933, only 11 months after Hitler took power, this article frankly admitted that the Church was benefiting from the urgency to prove that, quote, one's grandmother was not a Jewess, unquote. During the Weimar Republic, from the end of the First World War until Hitler's rise to power in 1933, a Mormon district, they didn't have stakes back then, a Mormon district might have a single genealogical specialist. During the Third Reich, Mormon genealogical research exploded, and Utah temples were flooded with German pedigree charts and family group records. Most districts and many branches would call full genealogical staffs, consisting of a president, two counselors, and a secretary. Missions held mission-wide genealogical Sundays and special genealogical youth activities. One Mormon was questioned by the Gestapo because they suspected him of being Jewish. He knew he had to produce his three-generation pedigree chart to prove his Aryan purity. Instead, he astonished the secret policeman by pulling out proof of seven generations of pure-blooded German heritage. He bragged, "I passed with flying colors." The race to exploit the German penchant for genealogical research did not stop with the Second World War. In the immediate post-World War II era, the acting German mission president, Paul Long Heinrich, sought the permission of Soviet occupation authorities to take possession of whatever German family records he could find. In July 1945, 2 months after the end of the war, German civilians were subsisting on an average daily nutritional intake of 800 calories per person. Despite the urgency of providing for his flock's physical welfare, Long Heinrich found time to forage through the ruins of burned and bombed out Jewish synagogues, looking for names of Holocaust victims that he could submit to Salt Lake City. And you thought that perhaps this Holocaust victim thing started in mid-1995? No, it was going on for decades prior to that. They got caught in the last decade of the 20th century. Prior to the 1936 Olympic Games in Berlin, the LDS missionaries provided rudimentary basketball instruction for the German Olympic team. This came about when Germany, a country with no basketball tradition, felt the necessity to field a team in every medal sport. Only a handful of foreign university students, and the Mormon missionaries, by the way, knew anything about this American game. American elders taught the German second-string handball team, designated to compete as the German Olympic basketball team, how to dribble, pass, shoot, and play defense. This occurred in the midst of a well-publicized worldwide effort to boycott the Berlin Olympics, which Hitler planned to use as a showcase of Aryan supremacy. Articles appeared regarding the boycott effort within the news columns of the church-owned Deseret News. They came over the Associated Press and UPI wires. Then, the Deseret News church section ran a six-column picture of a Hitler-saluting basketball team, along with an article that stated, quote, "Herr Hitler has sought the services of the elders to teach basketball to the team that he hopes will achieve a Nordic victory." The church published Deseret News in its Mormon religion section never hesitated to publish pictures of church leaders in conjunction with swastika symbolism. This is the picture of Church President Heber J. Grant appearing at a banquet in Frankfurt in the summer 1937. The rented building belonged to the National Socialist Teachers Union. Naturally, it came equipped with a large swastika flag, as did all such venues in Germany at the time. 1 year earlier, the same Deseret News church section ran a large picture of European mission president Joseph F. Merrill standing beneath a large swastika flag in a rented hall in Berlin. The issue wasn't the fact that these church leaders had appeared in buildings adorned with a Nazi party flag. That couldn't be avoided if you were going to go to Germany at this time. Instead, the historically noteworthy observation centers on the fact that the church-owned newspaper in Salt Lake City regularly ran wire service stories describing Hitler's treatment of Jews and political dissidents in Germany. But if the prophet or some other important church leader was in the picture, the swastika ceased to be an onerous symbol. Some of this accommodation with the Nazi worldview came at a much more unfortunate price tag. Mission leaders purged German hymnals and lesson plans of any reference to Zion, Israel, or any other wording that could be linked to the Jewish faith. There was no more "Ye Elders of Israel" or "Israel, Israel, God is calling." The choir, those pages came out in hymnals. Okay. In one instance, a freshly printed instructional manual was noted to have an inadvertent reference to Judaism. The mission president issued orders for the offending page to be cut out and the two facing pages to be glued together. Much more disturbingly, in some Mormon branches, converts from Judaism were shunned. One branch president, a Mormon lay minister in a small congregation, put a sign in front of his meeting house, "Jews are not allowed here." This was Arthur Zander, Helmuth Huberner's ecclesiastical leader, whom we will talk about later. Zander once ordered that pictures of Jesus Christ and Joseph Smith be removed from the walls of his St. Georg meeting house near Hamburg and be replaced by a portrait of Adolf Hitler. He would modify the Sunday meeting schedule to incorporate the Führer's radio speeches and then lock the meeting house doors so that members of the branch could not leave. He incorporated the Horst Wessel song, the Nazi Party anthem, into choral practice. Then he sent children around as spies, roaming around the room to report on whether the adults were singing the Nazi songs as fervently as they sang church hymns. The wife of one American mission president rode in Hitler's limousine with the Nazi woman's leader and the Führer himself on the way to Hitler youth encampments. This is a hell of a story. Elisabeth Welke forged a special relationship with Gertrude Schultz-Klink, the National Socialist Reichsfrauenführerin, which eventually led to Welke's meetings with Hitler's. Here's how this came about. In the aftermath of the 1936 party rally at Nuremberg, a scandal was brewing under the surface in Nazi Germany. 100,000 German youth, including Mormon adolescents, attended that rally. Some 900 German girls, age 15 to 19, returned home pregnant. Paternity could not be established in 400 cases, which probably indicated that some young women had had multiple sexual partners. Elisabeth Welker, who was in charge of all young women's activities in a German-Austrian mission, was concerned for the welfare of Mormon young women who regularly participated in the Bund Deutsche Mädel, the League of German Girls. She wrote Schultz-Klink to inquire about moral standards in BDM camps. A relationship developed between the two women, which resulted in Welker writing a glowing account of the attributes of German adolescent females in an issue of the Improvement Era, along with homey admonitions for American youth to follow the example of German teenagers, for example, to wear modest clothing and eat sensible food and not let their underwear show. There was also disquieting passages in this Improvement Era article. One paragraph commented on the dating habits of German girls, noting that when a potential suitor came to visit, he'd find her pedigree chart hanging on the wall. This was to assure him that she would be a strong candidate for marriage so that they could build, in her words, a strong race. By 1937, Roy Anson Welker, Lizzie's husband, had recently returned from 3 years as president of the Berlin-based German-Austrian mission. He told the Salt Lake Tribune, "Jews are safer in Germany today than in many parts of the world." If Welker had uttered those words in 1935, after the passage of the Nuremberg race laws, he might have been excused for embracing a common misconception. Many Germans believed the violence against Jews would stop. Although they had lost their German citizenship, they were now subjects of the German Empire. Some Germans thought Jews would become protected citizens. By 1937, such an utterance was absurd. Welker also believed that Hitler showed favoritism to the Mormons and that the Nazis had based their monthly one-pot charitable meal custom on the LDS practice of Fast Sunday. It was a belief shared by many German Mormons. Other varieties of that myth held that Hitler had been saved on the World War I battlefield by a church member, that Hitler had read the Book of Mormon, that Hitler was even a secret Mormon. But Welker persisted in believing these myths for the rest of his adult life. Another American mission president was quite a bit more sophisticated. A little passage from chapter 10 of my book. Copenhagen's Regal Palace Hotel, glimmering in its recently remodeled splendor, hosted a brash newcomer at the annual meeting of the European mission presidents in May 1938. Among the 11 middle-aged men who attended with their wives, the most popular discussion topic concerned an energetic, aggressive former businessman and political activist from Salt Lake City who had won his position in the Berlin-based East German mission presidency in a power struggle with a rival mission leader. Before the conference began, Alfred C. Rees had intrigued but mystified his colleagues with a cryptic memorandum that claimed that he had extracted, quote, some important unprecedented concessions from the German government, unquote, actions he couldn't mention specifically in writing, but would be discussed in the meeting. Franklin J. Murdoch, the president of the Netherlands mission in 1938, recalled that a number of his contemporaries expressed discomfort with reports of close collaboration between Rees and the government of the Third Reich. Some, mindful of the way the Nazis were regarded around the world, believed that such an unsavory association would sully the church's reputation. Others, thinking pragmatically, maintained that Hitler's government could not be trusted to live up to any bargain it struck with the Mormons. Rees appealed for his colleagues' patience and trust. Murdoch, however, employed his own method for assessing Rees' devotion to Adolf Hitler. One morning, while the mission presidents were descending a long, ornate staircase in the Palace Hotel's lobby, Murdoch silently positioned himself behind the German mission leader. Murdoch recounted, quote, he didn't see me. I put my hand on his right shoulder quickly, and I said, Heil Hitler! Murdoch described Rees' sudden, startled reaction, quote, he swung around and said, Heil Hitler! Showing that he was used to that, and that he would go along with that. I did it just jokingly, to scare him, you see. But after he recovered, he said, quote, oh, you'd better be careful. I have a weak heart. But I wanted to test him out, to see if you could get him, unsolicited and unbeknownst to him. How quickly he responded, Heil Hitler. Of course, that wasn't the thing for an American to do, unless you were in favor of the regime. Rees' colleagues had reason to suspect him of an unprecedented degree of collaboration with the Nazis. His reputation had preceded him. During 23 months as a mission president in Germany, Alfred C. Rees did more to affiliate the Mormon Church with the National Socialist than any predecessor. He met with important business leaders and state officials. He forged an agreement with Joseph Goebbels' propaganda ministry to purge daily newspapers of anti-Mormon articles and arranged for his missionaries to publish positive accounts of the LDS Church in municipal newspapers around Germany. When the most important Nazi Party daily subsequently printed an article about the Mormons that Rees did not like, he arranged for the Fränkische Beobachter, the People's Observer, to publish an article that he had written that drew numerous parallels between Mormonism and Nazism and between Utah and Germany. In the weeks before the outbreak of the Second World War, Rees' savvy media relations skills prompted a Nazi-controlled radio station to broadcast a shortwave program on Mormon topics intended for a Utah audience. Yes, this was a radio station in Nazi Germany preaching the gospel to Utah. His excellent command of the German language allowed him to cultivate business and government contacts that a speaker with less fluency could not have accomplished. In the autumn of 1937, Rees and his wife traveled to the annual Nazi Party rally in Nuremberg, where they enjoyed torchlight parades, fireworks displays, and other spectacular swastika-themed pageantry in the company of the local Mormon missionaries. When Italian fascist dictator Benito Mussolini visited Berlin, Rees posed as a correspondent for the Los Angeles Times in order to receive a prominent viewing pass. Based upon his response to his colleague's surprise prank in a Danish hotel, Rees presumably rendered the Heil Hitler greeting with shameless regularity. Mormons willingly served in the National Labor Corps and in the German Army. They enlisted as brown-shirted stormtroopers and black-shirted SS in much the same proportion as Catholic and Protestant Germans. Mormon children were as enthusiastic about the Hitler Youth and the League of German Girls as other boys and girls. One Latter-day Saint maintained specialized equipment in Auschwitz. That's a euphemism for a gas chamber and crematorium mechanic. Another Mormon baptized in 1923 joined the brown-shirted SA 5 years later in 1928. He ran a wild concentration camp in a converted Berlin police station. He tortured and killed Hitler's political opponents, mostly communist and social democrats. He presided over a chamber of horrors. He beat prisoners with a rubber truncheon and sliced open the soles of their feet, packing pepper into the wounds. He exercised prisoners to the point of exhaustion, then gave them a concoction of urine and feces to drink. Then, as a military policeman during the war, he was on duty at the scene of liquidated Jewish ghettos in Poland. When he faced post-war trial, the American mission president, Walter Stover, paid his pretrial bail. Inability to produce a living eyewitness to the murders and expiration of the statute of limitations on his non-lethal crimes meant that Erich Krause never faced justice. He died as a full-fledged, honored member of the church in 1981, having enjoyed callings as a stake genealogy leader and as a high councilman. I wrote this book to give my readers a historically accurate version of how the Mormon experience in Nazi Germany transpired, and more importantly, how today's Mormons choose to remember their past. When the Second World War ended, the Battle of Memory began. After World War II, more than 4,000 Germans came to the American Zion. They wanted to build new lives and to forget certain aspects of their old lives, but the innocent past has a way of resurfacing. The inconvenient past has a way of resurfacing. In the 1970s, their desire to dim an undesirable memory beacon ran headlong into a conflict with a trio of BYU professors, a German linguist, a historian, and a playwright, who wished to brighten the memory beacon of a young man named Helmut Hubiner. Hubiner is the quintessential Mormon memory beacon. He comes equipped with a dimmer switch that LDS authors and church leaders can use to ratchet up or dial down his memory according to the perceived needs of the church. For those of you who may not have heard of Hubiner, for those few who probably haven't, I will provide you the 1 minute Hubiner. Helmut Hubiner was a 16-year-old Mormon boy in Hamburg when he began listening to the forbidden wartime broadcast of the BBC. He wrote anti-Nazi tracks on a church typewriter, and his two Mormon teenage cohorts scattered them around Hamburg's neighborhoods. He was betrayed by a colleague at work. He and his adolescent cohorts suffered interrogation and torture at Gestapo headquarters. Then, after a kangaroo court before red-robed Nazi justices, he died on a 19th-century guillotine. 10 days after Hubiner's capture, his Nazi-sympathizing Mormon branch president excommunicated him. Unfortunately, for most of the faithful, that is the extent of Mormon history in Nazi Germany. They know nothing about the post-war machinations over Hubiner's memory. The resulting on-campus play in 1976 drew long serpentine lines, as generally happens only when tickets are sold for football, basketball, or rock concerts. The student actors in Thomas Rogers' play Hubiner received campus recognition comparable to star athletes. They looked forward to taking the play on the road to California, where wealthy BYU alumni had offered to sponsor the production. But the Mormon hierarchy shut down subsequent performance of Tom Rogers' play and delayed publication of related research by Alan Keel and Douglas Tobler. Recent German immigrants to Utah, some of whom had been members of the SA and the SS, were uncomfortable with the limelight being focused on a young man that they still considered to be a traitor. They also wished to darken the historical spotlight on their own past. The LDS leadership was afraid that the Mormon youth in communist East Germany, where a substantial number of believers remained, might rebel against the government, much to the chagrin of the BYU professors, who maintained that the East German government would never confuse an anti-fascist with an anti-communist. Even when Huebner's co-conspirators wrote their own books, faithful publishers consulted Mormon general authorities for guidance. One book, ghostwritten for Huebner co-conspirator Rudy Voba, did not mention Huebner's excommunication in two separate editions published 10 years apart. As late as the first decade of the 21st century, a senior Mormon apostle, Boyd K. Packer, was allowed to review and then to rename a BYU-funded film about Helmut Huebner. The church leadership is not the only body that attempts to exercise control over the collective memory of Mormonism in Nazi Germany. Individuals and families also brighten and darken those beacons of memory. In 1995, 19 years after Dallin Oaks and Thomas S. Monson put a stop to Huebner-related scholarly publication by BYU faculty, Alan Keel and Blair Holmes published a scholarly monograph on the subject. But a decade after that, Richard Lloyd Dewey bought up all the unsold copies of the University of Illinois Press's stock of the book. Dewey, who had once written a faith-promoting biography of Mormon gunslinger Porter Rockwell, had published his own version of Huebner's life. More than half a century after Huebner died on a Nazi guillotine, the shenanigans of memory regarding his life had still not abated. Do you know that the Mormons have their own version of Oscar Schindler? In the case of Max Reschke, his family has controlled the dimmer switch that limits the commemoration of his heroism. Max Reschke was a Hanover industrial shop manager and a Mormon branch president. He saved two Jews from almost certain death. He unsuccessfully tried to hide another Jewish man in his house and sent his child with nourishment to that man's wife in the Hanover ghetto. As a German citizen in wartime, he displayed uncharacteristically charitable behavior toward enemy prisoners. He went out of his way to preserve the lives of a Polish slave laborer and a Russian prisoner of war. Max Reschke was a stubborn man. He opposed the pseudo-unionization of his shop workers by the Nazi labor front. He protested the absorption of the LDS Boy Scout troop by the Hitler Youth. When a brown-shirted youngster arrived at his house seeking to conscript one of his young sons, Max threw the kid out by the seat of his trousers and the scuff of his neck. When a Nazi peddler tried to sell him a tin swastika badge to fund the 1935 Nuremberg rally, Max loudly rebuked him, saying he wasn't a party member and wouldn't pay a pfennig. When Hitler conducted a plebiscite to ratify the remilitarization of the Rhineland in 1936, the Führer received 99% of the vote, or so the government announced. Max Reschke conspicuously voted no, and like he often did, he attracted the attention of the Gestapo. According to his son, the secret police was so familiar with this rebellious industrialist that he didn't have to go through the normal booking process when brought into the station house. They had his information on file already. His secretary at work devised a code to let the family know that he was once again in trouble with the law. Quote, "Max is out of town," she would tell Max's wife. An ordinary citizen would not have survived such a rebellious streak in Nazi Germany, but like Oscar Schindler, Max had powerful friends in local industry that would intervene on his behalf and get him out of jail. On the night of November 9th and 10th, 1938, Max displayed his greatest bravery and took his biggest risk. He witnessed the horrors of Kristallnacht, that nationwide Nazi-directed pogrom that saw Jewish shops vandalized, synagogues burned, and thousands of Jews either killed or shipped to camps. Max recognized a familiar Jewish couple in the company of a brown-shirted thug. Impersonating a plainclothes policeman, he flipped his lapel quickly, flashing a non-existent police badge. He told the guard, "I'll take these two," and somehow succeeded in the subterfuge. Then he embarked on a 400-mile cross-country odyssey, driving the couple throughout the night and the next morning, eventually crossing the Swiss border and delivering them to safety. Why do Max's heroics remain almost unknown? Why is there a filter of memory on what would otherwise be a very logical hero for Mormon and the Mormon hierarchy and the Mormon establishment to promote? Historians Douglas Tobler and D. Michael Quinn revealed his exploits almost 20 years ago, although buried deep in Tobler's scholarly in one of Tobler's scholarly articles and in an appendix to Quinn's book. Mormons seem fascinated with Helmuth Huberner, whose puerile rebellion saved no one but cost him his own life. It would seem that Max Reschke would be a natural recipient of Mormon adulation. But he remains relatively unknown today, and that's on purpose. Before Max's son, Horace, died a few years ago, he told me that the family's simple modesty discouraged them from seeking recognition from their father. That could be. But I have two other suggestions. First, like Huberner, Max Reschke did not adhere to the Mormon survival strategy in Germany under the Third Reich. Max refused to go along and get along with a totalitarian government that he despised. Saving two Jews, trying to save two more, and sheltering foreign captives certainly corresponded to heroic Christian charity, but not necessarily the 12th Article of Faith. The second possibility is even more intriguing. Like Oscar Schindler, Max Reschke saved lives, but he couldn't save his marriages. Max was a ladies' man. Max married three times. He stayed married to his first wife, Ida, for 9 years. When they divorced in 1929, the woman whom Max would marry 1 month later was already pregnant with his first of four children. Wilma and Max remained married for 14 years. After their divorce, Max married a third wife shortly thereafter, a woman who had been a domestic servant in their home. But before he could marry Lily, Max became involved with a fourth woman with whom he had a love child. Lily married him anyway and eventually cared for Max's illegitimate son, Klaus. Max's philandering attracted the attention of the German Mormon wartime leadership, who excommunicated him. Stubborn as ever, Max refused to attend his church court. Too bad he didn't have an ex-Mormon conference to go to. Max was eventually rebaptized, having both his membership and his priesthood restored. 8 years after the Second World War, Max, Lily, four of his children by Wilma, and his love child by his mistress, emigrated to the United States. In Utah, they attended the temple and were sealed together for time and all eternity. The Mormon concept of marital and family duration, well, you know that. To the world, Max Reschke would have been a hero. To the Mormons closest to him, his marital infidelity, which may have occurred while he held the trusted position of branch president, may have been a disqualifying factor in his heroism. Perhaps the Reschke children, who endured the dual pain of wartime suffering and marital discord, believed that honoring their father's life-saving courage would be more appropriate in the world to come. And so, I'll leave it to you. In the second decade of the 21st century, is the Mormon culture ready to accept a courageous but flawed hero like Max Reschke? Or do we still demand that our heroes be young and pure like Helmuth Huberner? Schindler's list was 1,300 names long, but Oscar Schindler cheated on only one wife. Is there room in Mormonism and in the ex-Mormon community these days for a fallen branch president who saved four people and tried to save two more, but cheated on two, if not three, wives? These are the kinds of fascinating contradictions that I encountered during my many years of research on this subject. There are more, and I could go for another hour, but perhaps it's time to stop and ask you and take your questions. Yes, sir.
That's an astounding and gut-wrenching presentation. Thank you very much. My name is Steve Benson. My grandfather received a book from J. Ruth Clark in the early 1950s, Protocols of the Elders of Zion.
Yes.
Very anti-Semitic work.
Yes.
And you mentioned how Clark was such a beacon, so to speak, for the church's anti-Semitic positions
during the war. What link or what kind of evidence is there, if any, between J. Reuben Clark's anti-Jewishness and Heber J. Grant's view on where the church should go with regard to the Nazis? Is there any correspondence? Is there any
links the two? Not that I've uncovered, because a lot of the minutes of the, you know, obviously the minutes of the First Presidency meetings are not available to us. Also, the minutes of the First Presidency correspondence files are not available to us, and we have a little window into that through D. Michael Quinn, who, as the authorized biographer of J. Reuben Clark, was given the rare privilege of going into the correspondence files, all those letters that members wrote to the First Presidency and the answers that they gave back. Obviously, there's a reason for this. People write the First Presidency to confess to crimes ranging from marital infidelity to manslaughter. Okay, so there's an excuse for that. But I read the Michael Quinn papers in the Yale Library that has a lot of transcriptions of the correspondence files. And then I also read Quinn's two biographies of J. Reuben Clark. The first, the authorized one, and then the one afterwards, where he described Clark's own faith crises called Elder Statesman. Clark was a virulent anti-Semite, and he was a nativist and a xenophobe right from the beginning. He gave the commencement speech in 1898, when he got his bachelor's degree from the University of Utah. And he was infected by one of the bad sides of American turn-of-the-century progressivism, that is, the anti-immigrant sentiment. He got up and told the graduates of the U that America was having Europe's foul sewage wash up on its shores. And, of course, what he's talking about is Italians and Irish people. He's talking about Catholics. And then when he became what was called a Mormon in Babylon, is what Frank Fox described him in one of the authorized biographies, he went back east, went to Columbia University Law School, sat right through the Smoot hearings during the first decade of the 20th century. He embarked upon a career in which he would work in Republican administration State Department. He became an ambassador, he became an undersecretary of state. He started off in 1906 as an assistant solicitor of state. He'd worked for the government there, and of course Washington, D.C. had very many prominent Jews. And then when the Wilson administration came along and the Democratic administration, he went into private practice with law offices in Washington, New York City, and one little one here in Salt Lake City to do people's wills and things like that. He had Jewish clients, and he served in lawsuits as opposing counsel in litigation that involved Jews. And he became just an absolute virulent anti-Semite for sometimes conflicting reasons. Jews were too rich. Jews were not loyal to the United States. Jews were borderline traitorous. But you asked about Heber J. Grant's connection, and I just don't have I don't have enough primary evidence of Heber J. Grant's personal feelings with regard to anti-Semitism. I do know that when Grant went to Frankfurt and spoke below that swastika arm banner, He was his main idea was to tell German Mormons to stay where you are and build up the church, because the LDS Church from about the 1920s on discouraged what was called the gathering. And that was the standard boilerplate thing that Mormon leaders gave German Mormons, in fact, most Europeans at the time. Even though there were only about 98 authorized immigrations of German Mormons from the time Hitler took power in 1933 until the beginning of the Second World War. I wish I could answer your question a little bit better. Did you want to follow up, or should I take another question?
Oakes just bridled, and he said, "We allowed Quinn into the archives, with Quinn promising us that he was just going to do research on J. Reuben Clark."
And he did.
And he did. But while he was in, and I talked to Mike later, while he was there, he also took copious notes, 10,000 pages, handwritten, involving post-manifesto polygamy. And that's what really pissed off Oakes.
Yeah.
Because Quinn, didn't get permission from Oakes to delve into post-manifesto polygamy.
It's easier to say you're sorry and get permission, right? Yeah, Mike used to, you know, Mike never, interesting thing about Mike was on my doctoral dissertation committee at Texas A&M as a guest scholar. To this day, he doesn't use photocopies. Okay, he's an old school guy. He types, I'm sure he has a computer now, but he used to, in those days, he would bring a manual typewriter in and type at 100 words a minute. He was an excellent typist. And he would just start, he wouldn't leave margins on the paper. He would start in the upper left, you know, and go and just type and type and type and make few mistakes. Mike is an amazing historian. And I'm so lucky to have been able to study under him.
Just a little anecdote. Several years ago, I asked him almost the exact question. I just said, how can you continue to be able to write these books when, you know, after about 2.5 to 3 years, the doors were locked again and they wouldn't let him in? And he said, you have no idea how many boxes of information and copies of documents. I didn't know about the typing thing, but he's evidently still got a lot of source material.
Oh yeah, well he's got a book coming out by Signature on the Mormon in the third volume 3 in the Hierarchy series. It's coming out in February. It's on every church-owned business from 1830 to 1910. He, as much as any human being can, without the power to unlock church financial records, he's writing on the church's finances. And then he has also signed a contract with the University of Utah Press for his next book, which is going to be on fundamentalist Mormons from the Manifesto to 1925, when the polygamists started having their major fissures. He has sources within the Centennial Park Mormons down there on the Arizona Strip. They've paid for him to come and lecture them on Mormon history.
Okay, next question. Anyone?
Yes, go ahead.
Oh. Yeah. Is it you?
Oh, no, I just said, gee, can we come? Centennial Park.
Okay. Don't you find it kind of hypocritical that the hierarchy of Mormonism won't forgive that man that you were talking about, yet 14 million members of the church will stand up and sing hail to the prophet who had 33 to 40 wives?
I can't say it any better than you. There's a gentleman over here.
I have kind of a context-setting question. You had a slide that said there were 11,000 Mormons in Germany. How would that compare to the Jehovah's Witnesses, the Gypsies, the others that were highlighted as people who were persecuted?
Okay, the largest group of what we called, what Christine King called the New Religions, the foreign-based New Religions, the American New Religions, was the Seventh-day Adventist, who had about, oh, had about 25,000 members during the Third Reich years. They're an interesting contrast with the Mormons because they did everything they had to do to survive, but not one thing more. So when the flag came down the street, they raised their arm in the salute. When the draft notice came in for their children to go into the Reichsarbeitsdienst, which was the labor corps, which was a subterfuge by the Nazis to overcome the Treaty of Versailles limitations on the size of the army, the civilian work corps, but they drilled with wooden, you know, rifles. And then when they got drafted into Wehrmacht, they would send their kids, and they would do everything they had to do in order to survive, but not one thing extra, where the Mormons tried to exploit the situation for their mutual, you know, for their mutual benefit. You ask about the Jehovah's Witnesses. They had about 20,000 in Nazi Germany at the beginning. At the end, they had about 15,000 because they rebelled and they suffered terribly, and I write about them in their book. They were pacifist, but they would not go in the army. They would not salute the flag. They would not do anything in that regard, and up to one quarter of their membership either were executed, killed by thugs, died in concentration camps, or died after being released from concentration camps as a result of illnesses and injuries they had received there. One time, it was costing the Third Reich so much money for its full-throated campaign against Jehovah's Witnesses that municipal judges would sentence a wife and a husband to determinate concentration camp sentences, 6 months, a year, and they would let them do staggered sentences so one could take care of the kids while the other one was in the concentration camp. There are myths and there are realities, myths based on realities with regard to the Jehovah's Witnesses. One of them, which probably has a grain of truth, was there was a concentration camp commandant who would only let a Jehovah's Witness shave him because the Jehovah's Witness was the only inmate of a concentration camp that he would allow to put a straight razor to his neck. So they would not violently resist. But in one concentration camp, the Jehovah's Witnesses still proselytized among fellow prisoners and in one instance had a small underground printing press. Sounds like Hogan's Heroes, right? But they did. And the interesting thing is that of all the American small religions, you come fast forward to today, to the second decade of the 21st century. The one that suffered the most, the Jehovah's Witnesses, has about 160,000 active members in Germany. The Mormons have 38,000 with only a 30% activity rate. So the Mormons believed in the 12th Article of Faith in supporting the government. Jehovah's Witnesses believed the opposite. Who's doing better now? You know, there have been two books written, in fact, two books and a scholarly article written and published by the University of Utah Press on that. And it was probably authored by a man who had been a mission president of the North German mission in the post-war time. And they give a lot of information on that, but of course it goes through all the filters of having been written by a believer. Mike Quinn tells me that what needs to be my next book because he thinks that if I do some research on that, that I will see the other side of it and that I will try to fairly represent both of them. I can't answer that yet. I do other things for a living. I'm an airline pilot. And things like that. And writing this book took me 15 years. And if I undertake another scholarly project, it's probably another 10-year project because I'm going to go about it and I'm going to do it right. So that's a possibility.
Thanks for everything you've done and presented here. This is just a curious question from somebody who has never been a Mormon, but I've been doing a lot of research into Mormonism. So the Book of Mormon tells the story of Hebrews, Jewish people, coming to the New World. And they're the founders of the one true religion, which the Book of Mormon now presents to the rest of the world. Can you give me any insight at all as to why there was so much virulent anti-Semitism amongst the leaders of the Mormon Church when their book celebrates the Jewish people?
It probably coincided with when the Mormons at least ostensibly stopped practicing polygamy with the manifesto and said, now we really mean it with the second manifesto, okay? A lot of them, this allowed, and Thomas Alexander in his book Mormonism in Transition, he makes this point. He says that all of the vices of larger American society came to be embraced by the Mormons, who then saw themselves as mainstreamers. So there was a lot of anti-Semitism in mainline American thought, and eager to embrace the concepts of American progressivism, which 19th century, early 20th century progressivism, which had some really good stuff in it, but also had some liabilities. The best I can say is that the Mormons were, in that regard, were probably no different. And the fact that they were somewhat still in isolation and those ideas could percolate around. You know, in my book, I quote Fawn Brody, okay? Fawn Brody's father was Thomas McKay, who was a Mormon mission president in Germany. He served three Mormon missions in Germany, one as a young man and two as mission presidents, one during the late first decade of the 20th century, and then he came back and was a mission president in the Germany and in Switzerland and Austria during the late years of the Third Reich. Fawn Brody married a Jew, and that she met when she was doing her master's degree work at the University of Chicago. David O. McKay, her uncle, flew out to Chicago to dissuade her from marrying a Jew. Her father wrote, Thomas E. McKay wrote anti-Semitic letters to Fawn, trying to make dissuade his daughter from marrying outside of Mormonism. It ran rampant. In Fawn Brody's papers, you know, there's letters between her and Dean Brimhall, and several other Mormon intellectuals of the time, and she addresses the anti-Semitism in Utah, and the fact that why isn't the Deseret News, even though they run news stories about what's happening to the Jews over there, why don't they editorialize against what's happening to the Jews? And she said they're being very careful, not so much to protect the Mormons in Germany, but not to stir up a hornet's nest at home, where there was a great deal of anti-Semitism, where there was rationalization. And one line she wrote said, you know, the Mormons back home might look and see what's happening to the Jews and still realize that they're getting a lot of genealogical information as a counterbalance and say, God's works in strange and mysterious ways.
One more question.
Thank you for your presentation. You talked about J. Reuben Clark running a firewall or building a firewall around immigration and stopping Jews from emigrating while they still had a chance to get out. In the post-war environment, you had the German cities basically wrecked. So was there another gathering of Zion among German Mormons to Salt Lake City? I ask particularly because Arthur Zander, apparently a resident of the city.
Yes. There were two great diasporas of German Mormons going to Utah. One of them during the prosperous years of the Weimar Republic, between 1923, which was the end of hyperinflation, and 1929, when the Great Depression hit, and it hit Germany with rapidity and severity. During those 5 to 6 years, there were about 2,500 German Mormons that came over to the Mormon culture region. Then, to answer your question, between the years 1948 and 1962, when the church, in the latter year, 62, when the church quit using a certain form, there were about 4,200 Germans that came over from the area that had been Nazi Germany. And 1948 was an important reason, too, because a lot of those Germans who came over had been brown-shirted SS. A number of them had been black-shirted SA. Many of them had been in a Wehrmacht, which was not a crime. And it wasn't until about 1948 that the West Germans and the Allies, the French, the British, and the United States, the Western Allies, lost their enthusiasm for denazification. In other words, keeping signed and enrolled members of the Nazi Party and its subsidiary organizations from immigrating. About 1948 and beyond, they started getting more concerned with the Russian bear. Okay, and the Cold War was rising. Churchill had given his speech in Missouri at the time. And so in 1948 and subsequently, the windows opened so that German Mormons who had not acted so nice could finally wind up coming over. In my book, you'll see an interesting picture going back to the first diaspora, the world, the between the wars immigration. Fort Douglas, here in Salt Lake City, has a national cemetery. There is a monument there to 21 German POWs who were interned at Fort Douglas in Utah for World War I. And most of these were ships of merchant crews that were in U.S. ports when the United States went into the war in 1917. And all of their crews became prisoners. So we had a lot of German POWs in World War I in the 2 short years that we were in the war. Well, 21 of them died in captivity at Fort Douglas. And in the post-war, in the between the wars years, these German immigrants who came over built a monument in a U.S. national cemetery to enemy combatants who had died in an American POW camp. And in this picture I show, it's early 1939 before the Second World War started. And all these men who are, most of whom in this group photo, they're posing in front of this monument. And most of them are of the age that they're people who came over between the wars. The interesting thing is it had three swastikas in the picture because that was the German national symbol at the time. War hadn't started. It had a meaning, but that was the flag. So it was filled with Nazi, with bouquets of flowers, and wrapped with a swastika cloth around it and flags. There are two gentlemen in there with iron crosses on their civilian clothes, and those were iron crosses awarded during the First World War. And there's one guy wearing a brown uniform, military-style uniform, with a Sam Brown diagonal belt, and he's a member of the Bund, the German-American Bund, which was a pro-Nazi organization that existed in the United States, run by Fritz Kuhn out of New York, and they had a very active chapter in Utah.